In previous lectures, we have looked at who is liable to IPT, the rate charged, and how we calculate the premium on which IPT is based. Now we need to have a look at how you account for IPT and the rules on registration. Firstly, we will take a look at how you account for IPT. Most of the rules for this are contained within Statutory Instrument 1994-1774. Regulation 12 gives the basic rules for sending in IPT returns. Before we look at this, we need to know what accounting periods we need to send our returns in for. We are told this in Regulation 2, Subsection 1. It says that an accounting period, just like VAT, is a 3-month period. We will imagine that we have an accounting period for the quarter end March. Regulation 12 tells us that our IPT return is due by the end of the month following the accounting period. In our example, this would be due on the last day of April. The IPT return is Form IPT-100, which is called Form 4 in the legislation. Payment is also due by the end of the month following the accounting period. A 7-day extension is given for electronic payments. In order to determine what premiums fall within our accounting period, we need to determine the tax point. The basic tax point is the receipt of the premium. You can see this in sections 52 and 72 of the Finance Act 1994. However, a person may apply to use a special accounting scheme, which is also known as the written premium method, which can give a different tax point. You can read about this scheme from Regulation 20 onwards in the statutory instrument. The person has to make a request in writing to use the scheme and specify the date from which the scheme will apply to them. Once the scheme is in operation, premiums are not treated as received when the cash is received, but when the premium is due to him. See Regulation 23 for this. This tax point is overridden by Regulation 23, Subsection 9, where the due date falls within an accounting period earlier than the date it is written into the trader's records. In this case, the date it is written into the records is used as the tax point. To explain this more easily, we'll put some dates into an example. You are due a premium on the 29th of December. Because it's Christmas, the person who enters the premiums into the accounts does not do so until they come back from holiday, which is the 2nd of January. This company uses quarterly accounting periods that run in line with a calendar year. If we use the due date as our tax point, we will have to account for the premium in quarter ended 31st of December. If we use the date it is written into the accounts as our tax point, it will fall into quarter ended 31st of March the following year. Regulation 23, subsection 9, provides that the tax point is when we made the entry, so we don't need to account for the tax until quarter ended 31st of March. This is what the legislation says on tax points. However, customs may allow an insurer to use a different tax point if they have difficulty in following these rules. To finish off with our special accounting scheme and accounting for IPT, we'll look at a few other issues. If a person wishes to withdraw from the special accounting scheme, then they can write to customs and request withdrawal from a specified date. This will only be granted if all returns and payments of tax have been made up to date and the person has been within the scheme for a 12-month period. The 12-month rule is contained in Regulation 26. In addition, customs do have the right to expel you from the scheme if they believe protection of the revenue is needed. We've already seen that under the special accounting scheme, the tax point is created when the premium is due and not when it is received. What if we have accounted for IPT to customs, but the customer fails to pay us? Where this happens, we can make a claim for repayment, which is covered under Regulation 25, subsection 1, paragraph B, and part 4. This allows us to deduct the amount of tax on the return for the accounting period in which the customer failed to pay us. Alternatively, as customs are quite happy to hold on to your money, you can claim the deduction on a later return. In most cases, we are likely to be able to claim the credit on the next return after we'd originally paid the tax. And what if we make an error in accounting for the IPT due? For instance, we calculated incorrectly. If the error is a maximum £10,000, or if greater, 1% of turnover, subject to an upper limit of £50,000, then it can be corrected on the next return without having to be separately disclosed to customs. The turnover referred to for this particular indirect tax is the net IPT turnover, i.e. box 10 on the IPT return. Now we have had a look at how you account for IPT. When is someone liable to register? You will find the basic rules in Section 53 and 53AA of the Finance Act 1994. Imagine the following scenario. A company supplies dishwashers. When a customer buys a dishwasher, he also takes out insurance to cover the mechanical breakdown of the product for a 5-year period. This mechanical breakdown insurance premium is paid direct to the insurance company, and it is for £280. As well as paying this premium, the customer pays a separate commission or fee to the supplier of £20. If you read sections 53 and 53AA, it says that registration is required by a person who intends to receive taxable insurance premiums and taxable intermediaries who receive fees in relation to insurance contracts. The supplier is a taxable intermediary, and he has received a fee that is liable to the higher rate of IPT. So, as well as the insurer having to register for IPT, the supplier also has a liability to register. Hopefully, this scenario is ringing some bells from our last lecture. Registration is notified to customs on form IPT1, and this must be done within 30 days from when the person first intends to receive the taxable premiums. Unlike its sister tax, VAT, there is no threshold before registration is required. Therefore, IPT will be due on the first premium received. Note that it is the intention to receive premiums that generates the notification requirements. Deregistration is required by the end of 30 days from a person ceasing to intend to receive insurance premiums or taxable fees. If you want to follow this in your legislation, most rules are in Regulation 4 of our statutory instrument. One final point on registration is where a business is transferred as a going concern. In this scenario, the transferee may take over the registration number previously allocated to the transferor. This requires an application by both parties, which is Form 3 in the legislation, or IPT 68. As a result of this, the transferee will take over the existing liabilities of the transferor, as well as taking over their registration number. Regulation 7 of the statutory instrument gives more details about these rules. We have seen when someone is liable to register for IPT and how they go about it, but what if they fail to register? What penalties could be incurred? For a failure to register on or after the 1st of April 2010, the penalty will be based on the behaviour of the person concerned and is a percentage of the potential lost revenue. The potential lost revenue is the amount of IPT due from the date registration should have taken place to the date HMRC received notification of the liability to be registered. For a deliberate and concealed failure, the penalty will be a maximum 100% of the potential lost revenue. For a deliberate but not concealed failure, the maximum penalty will be 70% of the potential lost revenue, and for any other case, for example, due to lack of care, the maximum penalty will be 30% of the potential lost revenue. Reductions in the amount of the penalty are available for both unprompted and prompted disclosures. The table on the screen details the maximum and minimum penalties that could apply. Don't bother to learn this table off the top of your head. Use your legislation and highlight the relevant parts. Penalties will not be charged if the taxpayer has a reasonable excuse for the failure and the failure is not deliberate. The death of a close relative or domestic partner around the time that the person should have given notice is normally treated as a reasonable excuse, as is the serious illness of the person or a close relative. The legislation specifies that an insufficiency of funds is not a reasonable excuse, unless due to events outside the taxpayer's control. Relying on a third party is also not a reasonable excuse, unless the taxpayer took reasonable care to explain to the third party what they required them to do and made regular checks on progress. What if we fail to notify when we should deregister? You could be subject to a penalty, and this is covered in paragraph 17, subsection 1 of the same schedule. Again, you won't go to prison because it is only a civil penalty. Once again, this will not apply if the person satisfies customs that they have a reasonable excuse for the failure. The final penalty that we're going to look at is where someone makes an error in an IPT return. Schedule 40 to the Finance Act 2008 introduces a new penalty regime that will apply to accounting periods that end on or after the 1st of April 2009, where the document is required to be given to customs on or after the 1st of April 2010. Penalties will apply where a return contains an inaccuracy which leads to an understatement of tax.
Penalties will be charged if the error occurred due to a careless action, i.e. failure by the taxpayer to take reasonable care. This would apply, for example, if insufficient records were maintained or if a taxpayer estimated figures rather than obtaining accurate information. In addition, greater penalties will be charged if the error is deliberate, i.e. the person knowingly and intentionally submits an incorrect document but does not take steps to hide the error. For example, deliberately including an incorrect turnover figure on a return, but without creating false records to conceal the inaccuracy. Another example of a deliberate but not concealed error would be deliberately describing transactions inaccurately or in a way likely to mislead. Finally, an even greater penalty will be levied if the error is deliberate and concealed, i.e., an incorrect document was sent knowingly and intentionally and active steps were taken to hide the error, such as creating false invoices or destroying books and records so that they are not available. If a return contains more than one error, a penalty is charged for each error. The penalty charged will be a percentage of the potential loss revenue. The table on the screen details the maximum and minimum penalties that could apply. Reductions are available for both unprompted and prompted disclosures.
For reasons of administrative simplicity, we may like to effect a group registration, and this is covered in Section 63 of the Finance Act 1994. The legislation here is similar to VAT groups with one important distinction, which we will come to in a moment. Companies can form a group if, firstly, they are either resident in the UK or have an established place of business in the UK. There must be control between the companies, so essentially we are looking at more than 50% ownership.
And application needs to be made to Customs 90 days before it is to have effect.
Customs will only refuse registration if they believe it is necessary for protection of the revenue. Once an IPT group is in place, a representative member is appointed by the companies, and any premiums received are treated as received by that representative member. They have the responsibility to file the IPT returns and pay the IPT due. All members of the group are joint and severally liable for compliance with the legislation. This means that if the representative member fails to pay the tax, Customs can go after any one of the other members of the group. We mentioned earlier that there was one major difference between VAT groups and IPT groups. This is where one member of a group pays an insurance premium to another member of the group. This supply is not ignored for IPT purposes. IPT is still due on the premium. If we were looking at a VAT group, the supply would be ignored. Customs may cancel a group registration if it appears that the company has ceased to be controlled, and the group itself may amend its registration under Section 63, subsection 5, by applying to Customs. This could apply, for instance, where new members join or old members leave. We'll now look at record-keeping requirements that an insurer must comply with. Regulation 16 of SI 1994-1774 gives the details. This regulation requires a registered person to keep business and accounting records, policy documents, cover notes, endorsements, invoices, renewal notices, and credit and debit notes, evidencing any increases or decreases in premiums or fees.
Generally, these records should be kept for 6 years. However, Customs have the power to direct that records can be kept for a shorter period.
Let's now have a go at a couple of multiple choice questions.
What penalty could apply from the 1st of April 2010 if an insurer carelessly notifies registration 2 months late and it is unprompted? A. Minimum 35%, maximum 70% of potential lost revenue. B. Minimum 10%, maximum 30% of potential lost revenue. C. Minimum 0%, maximum 30% of potential lost revenue. D. 5% of the tax due with a minimum of £250. The correct answer was C.
Example 2.
How long does an insurer generally need to keep IPT records for?
A. 3 years. B. 20 years. C. 4 years. Or D. 6 years. The correct answer was D. 6 years. We are now going to look at tax representatives. We have already seen that it is the location of the insurance risk that determines liability to UK IPT. Therefore, if an internet-based company in the United States sells house insurance to UK resident individuals, the risk is located in the UK. The US company, therefore, has a liability to register for UK IPT and file returns and pay the tax on time.
It used to be the case that if the company did not have a business establishment in the UK, then they had to appoint a tax representative. This person was then responsible for completing the IPT returns and ensuring compliance with the rules. The requirement to appoint a tax representative is no longer compulsory as a result of the Finance Act 2008. A representative can be appointed if the insurer so wishes, but they will not be jointly and severally liable for the tax due by the insurer. The overseas insurer does still have to register and account for IPT, though, even if they don't appoint a representative. We'll now take a look at the circumstances in which you, the insured customer, could be liable for the IPT on the policy that you've taken out. You'll find this in Section 65 of the Finance Act 1994. The Finance Act of 2008 has also made changes to this section. Imagine that you have taken out insurance with an overseas company called BeSure. You are based in the UK. The overseas company has failed to register and account for IPT. You, the insured person, can potentially be assessed for the unpaid IPT. However, this is restricted to circumstances where the insurer is located outside the EU and is not covered by a mutual assistance directive or similar arrangement on the exchange of information and recovery of tax due.
Where this happens, customs may serve a liability notice on you, the customer. The liability notice will contain the amount of IPT due, which will have been assessed to the best of customs judgment. Such a notice imposes a joint and several liability on the insured person and the insurer. You will be required to pay the IPT due under the notice within 30 days of that notice. You can read this in Regulation 38 of our statutory instrument. This may seem unfair. When you paid your premium, you didn't expect to have to foot another bill with customs. All is not lost, as the legislation provides that where you have paid the IPT due, you have a right to recover the amount from the overseas insurer. In addition, you can have interest at 8% per annum. The interest will run from the date that you paid the IPT to customs up until the day that you were reimbursed by the overseas company.
We'll take a look at the records that an insured person must keep and penalties that customs could invoke. If the insurance relates to a customer carrying on a business in the UK and the customer has been issued with a liability notice, then he must keep records relating to that insurance contract generally for a 6-year period.
The records are detailed in Regulation 41, subsection 2, and include his business and accounting records, policy documents, cover notes, endorsements that he has received, invoices and renewal notices, and credit and debit notes. If he fails to comply with a liability notice, then various penalties could be invoked by customs. These are contained in paragraph 16 in Schedule 7 of the Finance Act 1994. The person will be liable to 5% of the tax that was due, subject to an overall minimum of £250, and could also face £20 for every day that the tax remains unpaid. There are various defences, one of which includes having taken all reasonable steps to pay, and if the person has been convicted of a criminal offence, then no penalty will be applied under this paragraph.
HMRC's powers to obtain information and inspect documents, etc., have historically been different across the range of taxes they govern. Under Schedule 36 of the Finance Act 2008, new information and inspection powers have been introduced to provide for a common compliance checking structure for the now merged departments of the former Inland Revenue and Customs and Excise. Initially, the schedule only applied to income tax, capital gains tax, corporation tax and VAT. Now the schedule applies to the other indirect taxes of IPT, landfill tax, climate change levy and aggregates levy. Once again, it's not a useful exercise to try to memorize the powers that they have, but to open up your legislation and highlight where the powers live.
Generally, HMRC use an informal approach to obtain information. If an informal approach is not successful, HMRC will issue a legal notice to provide information or produce documents, which is known as an information notice. HMRC can issue a written notice requiring a taxpayer to provide information or produce a document if it is reasonably required for the purposes of checking the taxpayer's tax position. This is known as a taxpayer notice. In addition, a third-party notice can be issued to a person requesting information or documents reasonably required to check another taxpayer's position. Third-party notices are generally only issued where the information required cannot be obtained from the taxpayer themselves. An information notice does not have the power to request a person to provide information relating to the conduct of a pending appeal, i.e. a document brought into existence as part of the presentation of a tax appeal, or journalistic material, or personal records, i.e. records concerning an individual's physical, mental, spiritual or personal welfare. There is a right of appeal against information notices unless the tribunal approved the issue of the notice. Inspections can be announced or unannounced. With an announced inspection, the inspection takes place at a time agreed with the person or with at least 7 days' notice. An unannounced inspection can only take place by or with the agreement of an authorised HMRC officer. Finally, HMRC have the power to impose penalties in respect of information notices and inspections. Where an information notice is not complied with or where an inspection approved by the tribunal is obstructed, a penalty of £300 can be charged. If the failure or obstruction continues after the first penalty is imposed, daily penalties of up to £60 per day can be imposed. In addition, a tax-geared penalty can be imposed by the upper tribunal where HMRC believe a significant amount of tax is at risk. Penalties will not be charged if the person has a reasonable excuse for the failure. There is a right of appeal against the penalties.